Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Maybe we ought to just be saying Detroit's big one, huh? While the domestic competition works its way out of bankruptcy, Ford is actually making money, almost $1 billion, we learned this morning. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 2nd of November today. Ford cleared $997 million last quarter, a tidy sum considering this has been one of the worst years for car sales ever. We figured cash for clunkers only went so far, so we asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out how Ford did it and where their road leads from here.
This is the first time in 4 years that Ford has posted a profit in North America. David Silver follows the auto industry for Wall Street Strategies. It's a research firm. He says Ford is finally seeing the results of changes that it started making years ago.
They've slashed production. They've closed a lot of factories across the country and across the world. And now as these UAW concessions that were made at the beginning of 2008 begin to filter in, it's really allowing them to truly turn a profit.
Those union concessions meant Ford has spent less money on labor lately. Cash for clunkers got people to buy cars, but the more important thing is Ford is finally building vehicles again that people want to buy. Even so, David Silver says,
they're really not out of the woods by any means. Even CEO Alan Mulally, you know, he indicated that they're not going to be solidly profitable until 2011.
Ford still has billions of dollars of debt to deal with, and its labor issues aren't over. It's still trying to thrash out a contract with the UAW. Bruce Belzowski is a researcher at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute. He says Ford's future will depend on a couple of things beyond cutting back.
They have to be prepared for a more fuel-efficient future.
And he says that Ford, like GM, will have to do well outside of North America.
How the companies manage and continue to manage their global operations will have a big effect on their success going forward.
Because if it's going to make it, Ford will need to be big in places like India and China, where the market for cars is still growing. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Goldman Sachs is doing way better than Ford. Its quarterly profits topped $3 billion last time around. That has the company shopping around for ways to slim down its tax bill. The Wall Street Journal reported this morning on one option that Goldman is said to be considering, buying unused tax credits from Fannie Mae. Sounds smart, but Marketplace's Steve Henn reports that it just doesn't look so good.
At first glance, this seems like exactly the kind of thing folks worry about when elected officials take over a private company. Politicians gumming up a perfectly logical business deal because of political considerations. Mark Calabrea is at the Libertarian Cato Institute.
Clearly, with questions of politics, there are also questions of perception, where, you know, you're responding to public anger, you know, whether or not that anger is rational.
Sure, few of us are eager to see Goldman Sachs trim its tax bill, but Fannie Mae owns these tax credits it can't use, so why not sell them?
Fannie Mae is not making profits and will hence not be paying taxes, so it certainly makes sense for Fannie Mae to sell off assets it has for tax offset.
After all, that benefits Fannie. And U.S. taxpayers basically own Fannie, so it should benefit us, too, right? Well, not quite. See, Goldman's not offering to pay full price for this tax break, so taxpayers would lose. And there's another wrinkle. The feds issue these tax credits to builders to stimulate the construction of affordable housing. Then builders sell them to banks or Fannie to finance their projects. But affordable housing advocates like Judith Kennedy worry that if banks like Goldman are buying old tax credits from Fannie instead of new ones from builders,
it means there will be fewer starts, fewer construction jobs, fewer affordable rental units at a time of, you know, foreclosure crisis when we need more rather than less.
But on the upside, there would be one big tax break for Goldman Sachs. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
An update now on a story that we have been bringing you. and bringing you for the past couple of months. After much backing and forthing, CIT finally succumbed to Chapter 11 bankruptcy yesterday. Late last year, Washington put more than $2 billion in TARP money into that company on the theory that CIT is a critical lender to small and medium-sized businesses. Now, though, it's up to a bankruptcy court to sort things out. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
CIT is primarily a lender to small and mid-sized businesses. It was risky loans to homeowners and students that got it in trouble. The government decided just one infusion of capital was enough for CIT. Scott Stewart is a partner at bankruptcy consulting firm Donlin Racano. He says if CIT makes it out of bankruptcy, it could be a game changer.
If this succeeds, it will be a victory against a high level of regulation in that the free market forces, the investment community, the bondholders came together to find a solution.
Stewart says not plowing more government money into CIT was risky. For one thing, it left thousands of businesses scrambling for credit. And it took a big risk with taxpayer money.
$2.3 billion is a quite significant amount.
Doug Roberts is chief investment strategist at Channel Capital Research. He says that bailout probably saved CIT, its customers, and the Treasury more money down the line.
Without the government involvement, CIT could have gone the liquidation route, and there's no guarantee that that capacity would have then been taken up by somebody else.
The bad news is that so far, other banks haven't started lending more to small businesses. Once it's out of bankruptcy, CIT will be smaller, but it should be in a better position to help. It'll shed roughly $10 billion in debt, and it's getting $1 billion in cash from financier Carl Icahn. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Boy, it was looking like a big day on Wall Street today, and then things got kind of bumpy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Not for nothing, but have you seen a good Terminator movie lately? Yeah, I didn't think so. The reason I ask is that the company that bought the rights to the Terminator franchise just a couple of years ago is bankrupt. So it's putting the brand that Arnold Schwarzenegger made famous up for sale, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
In the 21st century, a weapon will be invented like no other. The Terminator.
Production company Halcyon paid about $25 million for the Terminator franchise. It hopes to more than double that. Kevin Schultz is with FTI Capital Advisors. It's handling the sale. He says a buyer could apply the rights to a wide range of products.
Not just film sequels, but also games, merchandise, TV series.
Rights to the older blockbuster movies aren't included, just Terminator 4 and everything after. UCLA's Nelson Gayton.
It's proven itself globally. A question is whether this franchise's brand value has played out.
No word on price yet. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles just sold for $60 million, and Gayton expects studios will like Terminator's potential for a resurrection. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger will be available next year.
I'll be back.
Killer droids can't seem that scary after 6 years of politics. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is Election Day in some parts of the country, including the country's biggest city. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is running for a third term. And besides name recognition, he's got another huge advantage going for him, the size of his wallet. Bloomberg is far and away New York City's richest man, to the tune of about $16 billion. He's expected to spend as much as $140 million of it on this race. His opponent, less than 10% of that. From New York Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
The only word that could be used for the amount of money that's being spent is obscene.
That's the Democrat in the race, City Controller Bill Thompson. What's Bloomberg's response?
Cost a lot of money to get a message out, and I'm trying to show what we've done and tell people.
Chris Smith has covered Bloomberg for New York Magazine since he first ran for mayor in 2001. He says the mayor is spending so much in part because he can. Remember, even $140 million is less than 1% of Bloomberg's money.
You know, you got to be honest. If you gave a bottomless checkbook to any political candidate, they wouldn't be restrained. They'd spend as much as they possibly could.
Trying to wipe out all potential hurdles and make sure they get what they want. But what does Bloomberg want other than a win? A lot of people, including Smith, say he hasn't proposed anything new or bold.
He's running on his record, and generally the people think he's got a good record.
People think he's got a good record. He's gotten the endorsement just now of the Times, the Post, the Daily News. It seems just excessive to spend all this money, given the fact that he probably would have won even if he was a millionaire or even a thousandaire.
Yeah, but you're never going to find a candidate who's going to assume he's going to win. And Bloomberg and the strategists he employs believe in a Colin Powell doctrine, you know, use overwhelming force.
Political scientist Jennifer Steen at Yale is baffled by Bloomberg spending. She's studied self-financed candidates and says her research indicates money can't buy a win.
If you look at self-financed candidates as a class, they have a very poor track record. They tend to lose most of their elections.
Just look at presidential candidates Mitt Romney, Steve Forbes, and Ross Perot. She says all money can do is clear the field up front.
When a wealthy self-financer throws his or her hat into the ring, it often deters other potentially strong candidates from entering that same race.
In other words, it's about how much money a candidate could spend rather than what he actually does spend. And for some New Yorkers, all this spending appears to be hurting Bloomberg.
I kind of feel there's a little bit of dictatorial behavior there.
He's okay, but I just don't like the way he flaunts his money around, so I'm not for him.
But polls indicate most people are for him, something Chris Smith says makes the mayor smile even more than knowing he owns one of the most powerful financial news organizations in the world.
You know, being a mayor of New York City brings you a kind of prestige and power that you can't get even running a major multinational company.
So would he spend $1 billion on the race? Smith says that might be a little much even for a 16-billionaire like Mike Bloomberg. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There are, very broadly speaking, two schools of thought on those rich pay packages a lot of Wall Streeters get. Either people are really mad that they even exist, or they are angry about the government's decision to limit them. Commentator and economist Susan Lee thinks the anger on both sides of that equation is misplaced.
Okay, I get it that people are upset about the government's pay czar setting compensation. But I also get it that there's a pretty good reason for it. These companies, after all, took government bailout money. That gave the government an ownership stake, and owners have a right to determine pay. Now, this all seems like a no-brainer until we consider the ultimate owners of these companies, the shareholders. Do shareholders have the right to set executive compensation? Well, no, absolutely not. Worse, shareholder owners don't have the power to set pay at companies who haven't taken bailouts. Here's how it works. The power to set compensation is in the hands of the company's board of directors, and a majority of these boards at a majority of American corporations is made up of friends of the CEO or other CEOs. Because there's honor among thieves, it's very unusual for directors to rein in huge pay packages, especially since the money doesn't come out of their own pockets. Now, Congress has tried from time to time to remedy this lopsided balance of power. Recently, the House passed a bill requiring boards to hold a shareholder vote on executive comp. But the vote would just be advisory. It wouldn't be binding. And so boards would be free to ignore it. And that's actually what happened in the UK last year. A majority of shareholders voted against the pay packages at Royal Dutch Shell, but the board awarded the money anyway. So, if you want to enjoy some righteous anger, then I suggest you focus on the inability of shareholder owners to determine pay. It's part of why we're stuck with so many overpaid, undercompetent corporate chieftains.
Susan Lee is an economist living in New York City. Send us your thoughts about what you hear on the broadcast. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, when picking insurance is like making travel plans.
You go on the website, you put in your zip code,
and also your birth date. And out pop 22 different policies that you can pick from.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials jumped out to an early lead today before riding a roller coaster of losses and gains. Blue chips finally settled 76 points above Friday's close. That's an increase of 0.7%, finished at 9,789. NASDAQ inched up 4.2%, closed at 2,049. The S&P 500 added 6 points, 2/3 of 1%, ended things at 1,042. Good news about growth in manufacturing helped put some wind beneath Boeing's wing. Shares of the airplane maker lifted nearly 1% today. Ford revved its engines, too. Investors hit the gas and drove shares up more than 8%. News that pending home sales rose last month initially helped raise the roof on shares of Home Depot, but the purveyor of bathroom sinks and ceiling fans ended the day just a fraction lower. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Nova Becoming Human on PBS, The Evolution of Evolution. Nova Becoming Human, Tuesday at 8, 7 Central on PBS. And by The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them. The Economist on newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday, November 3rd. Obama welcomes European leaders in D.C. for the start of a two-day summit with the EU. Voters in New Jersey and Virginia cast their ballot for governor. The elections will show which parties won over voters since Obama took office. And on November 3rd, 1986, a Lebanese magazine revealed that the United States was sending weapons to Iran in exchange for hostages. It was the beginning of the Iran-Contra affair. I'm Timothy Beckworth.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know those days when you're just crabby and a lousy mood for some reason that you can't quite put a finger on, and then when you get to work, you're all snappy with people who had nothing to do with why you're in such a lousy mood in the first place? Behavioral economists, Dan Ariely among them, say there is a word for that, and Dan is here to explain. It's good to talk to you again.
Same here.
So what does it say that I am actually feeling pretty good about talking to you today?
Well, when we had nice chats before, it must be that you remember how
nice I am.
I got
all your quiz questions right, so I'm feeling good about that.
Or maybe you're hopeful that you will get them right. So what happened is that, first of all, there's a question of how our emotion changes our decision-making. And it turns out that what we call incidental emotions, which is sometimes an emotion that is not because of the fact, could actually influence our decision-making. So, for example, imagine that you and I have a chat and you are delighted afterward, and you go and you're facing some other decision about investing in a bank or giving money to somebody or buying a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. It could be that your residual emotion that came from the discussion with me would nevertheless influence your next decision.
So let's say I had a fight with my wife this morning, or the baby was up in the middle of the night. Would that color my interactions professionally today?
So usually when we think about emotions, we think of them as fleeting, right? Mm. You feel something for a while and then it goes away. You got upset with your wife in the morning, and presumably next week you will not feel this way. But imagine that you got upset with your wife, you come to work angry.
Never.
You start behaving toward your producer in a way that is really unpleasant, unprofessional. And, you know, she behaves in a similar way. And next time you come to work, you don't have the emotion anymore. But you ask yourself, how do I usually treat her? And you say, oh, I remember how I treated her yesterday. I'm kind of rude and obnoxious. This must be the kind of way that I treat her usually. Let me keep on behaving this way. And therefore, you would keep behaving this way again and again and again.
What about, just to frame this in terms of the financial crisis and the whole economy thing, you know, let's say I go to do a trade in my stock portfolio and I'm remembering the cataclysm of the past year in the stock markets. Does that kind of situation apply?
Yeah, the same thing can happen in financial investment. So imagine that you go to your broker to discuss what's your risk attitude. And again, you come up after having a good night or a bad night with your wife. And because of that, your risk attitude is either higher or lower. And now you talk to your broker and you don't understand that much of your risk attitude is not based on your true preference for risk, but it's based on the fact that you're annoyed or upset or something like that. But you put an action into plan. You write it down. You decide your risk allocation and so on. Now this decision might actually escort you for the rest of your life until retirement because you've set it up on paper and you created this basically precedent for behavior that you'd later on follow.
And it seems to me it takes a very perspicacious consumer, a person who's intensely self-aware, to be able to either change the behavior one way or the other or not let these things influence them.
Yeah, I think it's basically impossible. You're right. It would mean that we would have to continuously analyzing where are we, why are we doing it, what are all the reasons for this, and I'm not sure anybody wants to live this way. But, you know, I also don't want this to end on a sad note, so let me give you kind of a positive...
Because that'll influence how you and I have our next chat, right?
So let's think about the positive thing. So imagine you're in a date, and you want the person you're dating to feel good about you, right? So if you go to a movie that is slightly scary, or if you serve to them a dish that has some hot peppers, and then they start sweating or their heart start kind of beating a little faster, if they don't know where this emotion is coming from, they might misattribute it and think, oh my goodness, the company of this person I'm with, it must be great because I'm so excited, I'm sweaty, my heart is pumping, and therefore be more likely to fall in love with you.
Dating advice from Dan Ariely. He's a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. His book is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
We have been doing our own practical research. Check it out on our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Department of Behavioral Economics. If Congress does eventually approve some kind of health care overhaul, virtually everybody is going to have to buy insurance or else pay a fine. Most Americans already get health insurance through their job, so they'll be okay. But those who don't have coverage will have to buy it on the open market, where insurance can cost a small fortune if it can be had at all. Under the bills that are making their way through the legislative process, people who don't get insurance through work would be allowed to shop at what are called health insurance exchanges, basically government-regulated markets for insurance policies. Today, as part of The Cure, our ongoing coverage of the healthcare overhaul, we take a closer look at those exchanges. Here's Joel Rose.
To understand how insurance exchanges are supposed to work, let's start with the only state that already has one, Massachusetts. Ada Mae Roberts runs a bed and breakfast in an old Victorian house in Salem.
Hi. Did you find the parking okay?
Roberts is in her late 50s, and she's pretty healthy. No cancer, no diabetes. But as she's gotten older, her health insurance premiums have been rising, sometimes by thousands of dollars a year. So when Massachusetts Health Insurance Exchange came online 3 years ago, she was eager to see how it works.
So you go on the website, you put in your zip code and also your birth date. And out pop 22 different policies that you can pick from.
Those policies are rated bronze, silver, and gold, depending on how much coverage they offer. Roberts chose a silver plan with a high deductible, but much lower premiums than she was paying before.
It's really helped. It's not just the money, it is the access and the choices that you have.
In most states, this is not how choosing an insurance policy works. There are plenty of plans out there, but no single place to look at all of them. And they're loaded with loopholes and limitations, so it's hard to compare one plan with another.
Today, apples to apples, forget it. It's like apples to rocks.
Karen Politz studies insurance policies at Georgetown University.
There's stuff that is really good coverage, and there's stuff that is just absolute junk, and everything in between. And it's very, very hard for consumers to see the difference, understand the difference.
Insurance exchanges are designed to change that. Under the health care bills now being debated in Congress, each state would have its own exchange, which would offer lots of different insurance plans with clearly defined costs and benefits. If there's going to be a public option, this is where you would go to sign up for it. MIT economist Jonathan Gruber helped design the exchange in Massachusetts.
It offers a convenient side-by-side comparison, and we think in that way promotes competition
because insurers know that people are going to be comparing them side by side against others.
Kind of like Travelocity for insurance plans. People who buy insurance through an exchange should also get a break on the price. That's because the exchange has thousands of members, which gives it the clout to negotiate with insurance companies for better terms. That's how it works in Massachusetts. But if exchanges become part of the national healthcare overhaul, the insurance industry wants to limit that clout. Robert Zirkelbach is a spokesman for America's health insurance plans.
There is broad support among our industry for having a exchange-type model that's going to simplify choices. The issue is really this whole question of how much regulatory authority do you give the exchange or the entity that's overseeing the exchange.
This is just one of several big issues that still have to be worked out. Another is exactly who is eligible to shop in the exchanges. In both the House and Senate bills, most people who can get insurance through their employers would have to take it. That would leave only about 22 million people nationwide in the exchanges. MIT economist Jonathan Gruber says that's just a small slice of the overall insurance market.
I guess I can't guarantee that that competitive effect will be large, but it clearly will be better than a sort of obfuscated market we have today where people don't really know what they're shopping for.
Health insurance is mandatory in Massachusetts, and thousands of residents have bought theirs through the exchange, but it hasn't been a cure-all. Healthcare costs are still going up in Massachusetts, and insurance premiums are rising along with them. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
For more of The Cure, that's our coverage of the healthcare debate. You can check our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an observation on the happenings right outside our studio windows. A new bank opened up across the courtyard from us this morning. Not so much new, actually, as just different. Just as things were wrapping up here Friday afternoon, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation came a-calling. The FDIC shut down California National Bank right next door to us, also eight others. The whole batch was bought up by U.S. Bank, which called its new acquisitions, by the way, part of its growth strategy. Think about this, though, the next time you hear the phrase too big to fail. There are plus or minus 8,000 banks in this country. The top 25 or so get all the attention. But 115 others have failed so far this year as of Friday afternoon. That is the most since 1992. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 76 points, about 0.8%. The NASDAQ inched up 4 points, 2/10%. The S&P 500 put on 6 points, 2/3%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time on the broadcast, as student loan defaults rise, are students getting the education that they are paying for?
They had worksheets where it was like, if you're deserted on an island and you have a list of things, put them in order of how they would be important to you. And I'm just like, are you kidding?
So that would be a no then. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.